So, I'm going to invite you to turn to Genesis 49. And we will begin our study of this chapter in Israel's history. Genesis 49:27, Jacob basically has just, there's just one verse that he uses to describe his blessing upon Benjamin, and here it is. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he devours his prey, and in the evening he divides the spoil. So let's take a look at this for a minute. Don't have a whole lot to say about it because it's pretty succinct. But when he says Benjamin is a ravenous wolf, like Judah's lion, the wolf is no less ferocious an animal than the lion, but usually kills far more than it eats. That's the difference. Benjamin would be characterized, according to Jacob, by a vicious and warlike attitude. He would be ravenous by nature, and his would be a mighty warrior tribe. And then notice he describes the outcome of this. He says, in the morning he devours his prey, and in the evening he divides the spoil. So the history of this tribe would be filled with examples of powerful ferocity. Benjamin's reputation, Jacob says, would be its warlike character and actions. Now, God's people need to learn to become warriors. Not so that we fight people, but so that we fight sin. Not that we fight Satan, but that we fight against our sin nature. We take up the full armor of God so that you will be able to resist the devils in the evil day, resist in the evil day, and having done everything to stand firm. And the point is that we would walk by the Spirit and not carry out the desires of the flesh. So we have a war as well. We should have a warlike attitude, a warlike character, warlike actions, a ferocious perspective when it comes to the sin and sin nature, so that we can walk in the Spirit and not desire, and not in the desires of the flesh. Now, with all that said, that's all we have. That's a description of Benjamin. But we see that played out in three different ways. And I'd like to do a review of the history of the tribe of Benjamin and take a look at the prophecy that Benjamin would be a ravenous wolf who devours the prey, and see how it found graphic fulfillment throughout the history of that tribe. So let's start with Joshua 18. Review of Joshua 18 and take a look at Benjamin's allotment. You know, he was given the strategic location, as we saw a moment ago, between the two tribes, the two big ones, Judah and Ephraim. And so Benjamin would have to develop a fighting spirit in order not to be overrun by either one of these two tribes. And according to Joshua 18, Benjamin became a buffer zone between the two dominant tribes of Ephraim and Judah. Now in verses 3 to 5, Joshua said to the sons of Israel, "How long will you put off entering to take possession of the land which the Lord, the God of your fathers, has given you?" And so Joshua came up with a plan. He said, "Provide for yourselves 3 men from each tribe. I'll send them out. They can walk to and fro through the land and write a description of it according to their inheritance, and then they can return to me, and then I'll divide it up." So after the tribe of Judah and Ephraim received their territory, the leadership of Israel gathered at a place called Shiloh in order to decide on the distribution of the land amongst the other tribes. And so the men went, verses 9 and 10 of Joshua 18, and passed through the land, and described it by cities in 7 divisions in a book. And they came to Joshua, the camp of Shiloh. And Joshua then cast some lots, and he divided the land amongst the sons of Israel according to their divisions. So the important question here, was which remaining tribe would receive the strategic territory between Judah and Ephraim. They just received their allotment, so who's going to slip in between? That's the question. That's why all of this is building up this way. And the survey was completed. Joshua cast lots to determine the next allotment, and the result would affect all the later history in that region. The die was cast, and the very first decision of record. Verse 11, voila, what happens? Now the lot of the tribe of the sons of Benjamin came up, according to their families, and they were given the territory between Judah and Ephraim. So that means, if you were a Benjamite, that your northern border was the border with Ephraim, and your southern border was the border with Judah. And this would place you in a precarious position between both of these double-blessed tribes who had aspirations to control the entire region. And Benjamin would be played against these two tribes throughout their history. And thus it developed, because of this, that strong warrior constitution that helped it survive throughout tribal intrigue and eventually played out between Ephraim and Judah. In verses 12 to 18, we learn about their borders. And he gives the entire border of the tribe of Benjamin. It's a detailed description in those verses. And what I want you to understand is the Ephraim-Benjamite border and the Ephraim-Judah border to the south were not meant to be clear-cut hard lines. There were a series of cities on both borders that would somewhat define the borders for Benjamin, but sometimes those cities would be consumed by Judah in the south. Sometimes some of the northern cities would be consumed by Ephraim in the north. It just depended on how strong Benjamin was at certain times in its history. So it was fluid. But both of the tribes were interested in chipping away at Benjamin's border whenever it was politically or militarily convenient for them. So in order for Benjamin to maintain its borders and its place amongst the tribes, guess what? It had to become a stealth fighting machine, especially as one of the smallest tribes of Israel. By the way, Jerusalem is on its northern border, and its southern border in Judah was actually in the borders of the tribe of Benjamin, not Judah. But because of the fluidity of the border, many times in Jerusalem's history it was found itself in Judah. It just depended on what was happening at certain times in the history of Israel. You know, God sometimes deliberately, purposefully places us in tight situations. Situations that will require tact, strategy, ingenuity, creativity, forthrightness to negotiate, just as with Benjamin. In the process, we can learn how to negotiate our way through to a successful conclusion, all the while our eyes kept on what's righteous. And I'm going to suggest to you that whether it's with Benjamin or whether it's with us, all of this is designed to not only increase our dependence upon the Lord, but also to test our faith and to shape our character. So wherever God places you geographically, socially, employment, ministry, family, that's where you're to bloom. That's where you're to bloom. And God's had you there strategically for the purpose of utilizing you and your assets for His glory. But sometimes those places are deliberately tight situations. Now, if we go to Judges chapter 3, that's Joshua 18, Joshua's allotting of the land of Benjamin. Here's a second incident in the life of tribe of Benjamin. A review of Judges chapter 3 with a man by the name of Ehud. Judge Ehud This is the first evidence of the ferocity of the tribe of Benjamin, as predicted in Jacob's blessing, was the judgeship of Ehud. This guy is a cool dude. He's the second judge of Israel, and he's a Benjamite. In verses 12 to 14 of Judges 3, it tells us the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord again. So the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel. Moab was a southeastern enemy of Israel, just on the other side of the Red Sea, or the Dead Sea, excuse me. God raised up King Eglon of Moab because Israel had done evil in the sight of the Lord. And so Eglon, seeing an advantage, some weakness in Israel at the time, gathered together some Ammonites and Amalekites, and they joined in league together and went and defeated Israel in the southern area of Judah and Benjamin. And they possessed the city of the palm trees, which is Jericho, just across the Jordan River. Jericho is the back gate into the Benjamite territory. You conquer Jericho, you have access to Benjamin, right to the heart and center of the tribe. You can also harass Judah to the south. So it's a strategic location for enemies. And then it says the sons of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, 18 years. So because of the strategic importance of Benjamin in the center of the country, if you can control Benjamin, then you can put an army in Benjamin, then you can infiltrate north into Ephraim, south into Judah, and cause all kinds of havoc. And so this is what Eglon was attempting to do. Create this kind of animosity and havoc in the center of the land of Israel. And this attack came from the king of Moab on the Transjordan as he crossed over the Jordan River into the oasis, the city of Jericho, the city of the palm trees, the back door to the land of Benjamin. So this Moabite presence was a real threat and difficult for the Israelites, as we read. They served King Eglon of Moab for 18 years. Verse 15 tells us, when the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord, he raised up a deliverer for them. And guess who it was? It was Ehud, the Benjamite. Notice it describes Ehud, the Benjamite, as a left-handed man. We'll learn more about that in the next incident. And the sons of Israel sent tribute to him, the king of Moab. So God raised up Ehud, who finally decided to make a move against King Eglon after 18 years. He's a fearless warrior. He developed a well-thought-out plan as a ferocious warrior, remember he's a Benjamite, to address the problem of Moabite oppression of 18 years. And the Bible goes out of the way to note that Ehud was a left-handed man as part of his plan to set the score straight with King Eglon. And if you read further in verses 16 to 22, Ehud made himself a sword, and it had two edges. In other words, both sides were sharp. It wasn't just a one-edged sword. And he bound it to his right thigh because he's a left-handed man. Okay? Hid it underneath his cloak and came as a tributary to bring tribute to King Eglon into his palace. And we note in the text that it says, now Eglon was a very fat man. All right? Ehud came to him while he was sitting alone in his cool roof chamber in this hot day. And Ehud said, I have a message from God for you. And so he arose from his seat, and Ehud stretched out his left hand, took the sword from his right thigh, and thrust it into King Eglon's belly, it says. And the word of God is interesting because the word says the handle also went in after the blade and the fat closed over the blade. So he's obviously a obese man. For he did not draw the sword out of his belly and refuse came out. So he must have got him right in the center of his gut. And what we learn from this is Ehud single-handedly assassinated King Eglon, concealing his weapon. And then the resulting confusion led to a great victory over the Moabites in Jericho. And then it says it resulted in an 80-year period of peace in the region. They struck down 10,000 Moabites, all robust and valiant men, and no one escaped. So Moab was subdued that day. So what we must do sometimes is to take action when it comes to champion righteousness. It's not sufficient to take a stand against, or to take a stand about God's will and word. It's okay to do that, but it's not enough. Sometimes it requires action. Like Ehud, we must also do something about the application of that righteousness. Otherwise, we do nothing. You know, we talk, we don't take any action, it's just a bunch of words. You know, it's one thing to stand against, let's say, homosexuality or cohabitation. It's another thing to be Ehud and to do something about by addressing it, confronting it, taking appropriate action to change it, to address it. We're not to be at war with people, but we're to be at war with the ways of the world. And like Ehud, he's looking for us. Are we willing to do that? Are we interested in doing that? That's the second incident. And the third incident is in Judges 19 through 21. It's what I call the Benjamin beating. This is a sad commentary on the nation of Israel. It's one of the most tragic episodes in the history of the region of Benjamin. A tribal civil war which reduced the tribe of Benjamin to a mere 600 fighting men. Beginning in verse 1, it begins with a very strange incident in Judges 19. It came about in those days when there was no king in Israel that there was a certain Levite staying in the remote country, hill country of Ephraim, who took a concubine for himself from Bethlehem in Judah. We don't have any other background, that's the story. Unlike most accounts in Judges, the story is entirely an internal problem. There are no Philistines involved in this story. There'll be no Moabites involved. There'll be no Canaanites involved. This is simply an internal story happening just with the Israelites. No famous deliverer like Samson or Deborah will emerge, or Ehud. The person who precipitates the drama is known as a certain Levite. And the closing phrase of the entire episode underscores the cavalier spirit that prevailed in Israel at this time. There was no central authority. Here's the description. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. Fast forward to verses 14 and 15. This certain Levite had taken a concubine. She left him after a while and went back to Bethlehem. Several months later, he decided to go find her. He goes back to Bethlehem and finds her in her father's household. After several days passed, he finds her, takes her, and he's beginning to bring her back to Ephraim in the north where he lived. And so in verse 14 and 15, they passed along and went their way, and the sun set on them near a place called Gibeah, which is in Benjamin. And they turned aside into that city in order to gain lodging in Gibeah. And when they entered, they sat down on the open square of the city because no one would take them into their house to spend the night. Traveling back from Ephraim back down to Bethlehem to get his concubine and bring her back, the Levite and his entourage found no immediate hospitality at nightfall in the city. Sometime as they're sitting there later, a gentleman of Gibeah noticed them sitting in the square, a traveler in the open square of the city. And the old man said, I'm now going to my house and no man will take me into his house. And so this guy took him into his house and gave his donkeys fodder to eat and washed their feet and ate and drank. You know, one of the main causes of moral decadence in Israel at this time was their self-centered, I think, attitude, resulting in a complete lack of concern for others. You know, this guy had received warm hospitality in his concubine's home back in Bethlehem. The father, he kept there for 5 days, and they feasted and ate. And on his way back, in this city of Gibeah, it's exactly the opposite. One man decided to find him late at night and said, well, you shouldn't be staying out here, and took him in. And so in verses 25 to 26, while they're celebrating in the home, the men of the city, it says, certain worthless fellows surrounded the house, pounding the door. And they spoke to the owner of the house, the old man, saying, bring out the man who came into your house, and we may have relations with him. Now, the worthless men here repeated the request of the Sodomites in Lot's day. They said the same thing, you remember? What had previously characterized the Canaanites, unfortunately, now marked the Israelites. This is how decadent they become during the period of the judges. But the men outside would not listen. They were told to leave, but wouldn't listen. So what did the Levite do? The Levite man grabbed his concubine and brought her out to them. And they took her and raped her, it says, and abused her all night until morning, and then let her go at the approach of dawn. These are Israelites. What's happening in the land of Israel? In Benjamin. Benjamites. And as the day began to dawn, the woman came and fell down at the doorway of the man's house where her master was until full daylight. So these Benjamite men brutally and savagely and sadistically raped this concubine of this certain Levite all night long while he's being entertained for the night. The next morning, it says, a Levite opened the door, took his deceased concubine, she had died, put her on his donkey and walked the rest of the way to his home. And it says he took a knife and laid hold of his concubine and cut her in 12 pieces, limb by limb, and sent her to each of the tribes of Israel. Pretty sad, sick, sadistic situation. Well, when word finally got out about this very sad, sick, and sadistic situation in Judges chapter 20, verses 1 and 2, then all the sons of Israel, from Dan way up in the north to Beersheba way down in the south, including the land of Gilead, all the tribes on the eastern shore of the Jordan River, came out, and the congregation assembled as one man in a city called Mizpah, which is just across from Gibeah, where this incident happened. The chiefs of all the people, it says, even all the tribes, and they took their stand in the assembly, 400,000 foot soldiers. This is what we would call the Gibeah affair, because this is where this took place, this audacious, sadistic event. And it sparked a confrontation now between a number of the tribes of Israel and the little tribe of Benjamin. The Levites' rather crass report that precipitated such a united tribal front against Benjamin was rarely seen in Israelite history. It appears that no tribe wanted to be missing at this important moment in Israel's geopolitical day. It could be said, by the way, that this Gibeah affair was a convenient excuse to get the real issue on the table, which is who would control this territory. Would it be Judah or would it be Ephraim? Here's a chance for one of us to decide. Furthermore, the whole tribe of Benjamin refused to punish these guys. That's the problem. Nobody in Benjamin stood up to confront these sadistic men who had done this act or to bring them to justice. And this points to the Benjamites' sympathy for these perpetrators of this atrocity that happened in Gibeah. They've had months to do something about it. It's taken a while to get all this riled up, get the word out, and get the troops mustered, but here they are. And in the meantime, Benjamin's done nothing. Verses 16 to 48, you can read it. It tells us that Benjamin had 700 choice men who were left-handed. Each one could sling a stone at a hare and not miss. Pretty cool. But they were outnumbered, against these 400,000 warriors. Now, there were other men, you know, Benjamin had other warriors, but only 700 of them were this kind of a warrior. But in addition to that, he had others, because we know that that day there was a war, and all of Benjamin who fell that day were 25,000 who drew the sword, all valiant warriors, but 600 men hightailed it out and hid into the hills at a place called the Rock of Ramon, where they were for 4 months. And then the Israelites, the armies, turned back against Benjamin, struck all their cities with the edge of the sword, burned them down, took their cattle and all they could find, and left the tribe in smoldering ruins. So based on the fact that the Benjamites were unwilling to relinquish these guilty offenders, a major military confront initiated. Now, you know, we can make all kinds of comments about, well, this is a little bit over the top, or they could have figured out some other way to do it, and so on, but this is how it happened. As a result, Benjamin is now seriously weakened as a tribe because of this Gibeah affair. 600 Benjamite warriors survived this onslaught, and they're holed up for months in the wilderness, while the rest of the tribes tried to gather their wits about them and figure out what they're going to do next. The wolf had fought valiantly, that is Benjamin, but had been torn in the end. Judges 21:2-3 tells us, so the people came to Bethel after all this happened, and they sat there before God until evening and lifted up their voices and wept bitterly. Why, O God of Israel, has this come about in Israel so that one tribe should be missing today? Apparently, the rest of the tribes woke up to what had just happened, the conflict that they'd participated in and how costly it had been. Benjamin seriously weakened. Tribal energies had been depleted in an internal warfare. So unnecessary. Now they faced a greater peril. If Benjamin were allowed, let's say, to disappear altogether, now you got a vacuum created between the two biggest tribes. This could trigger even a bigger civil war amongst all the tribes, north and south, depending on who you aligned yourself with. It would pit Ephraim against Judah and for the control of the entire region and the strategic crossroads that came through this region. Some sort of an arrangement had to be figured out to avoid that eventuality. And they knew it. They knew it at this point. So in verses 13 to 23, the whole congregation gathered together of chapter 21 of Judges. And they spoke to Benjamin. And it says they proclaimed peace to Benjamin. And TJ read to us how they found wives for the Benjamites, these 600 Benjamites. Unique, crafty way to do that. Because they wanted this tribe to proliferate again, and to repopulate, and the wives weren't available for these 600 men, so they went and found them. And to replenish the tribe of Benjamin, wives were sought who survived the conflict. They licked their wounds and resolved their issues. Here's a lesson for us. Don't compromise with sin. Don't compromise with sin. Don't think it's better to sin and you can get away with it. Don't support those who compromise with sin. Don't stand with those who choose to compromise with sin. Don't make a case for those who choose to compromise. Don't advocate for those who choose to compromise with sin. Don't do that. Don't stand in league with those who compromise with sin. Don't put yourself in that position. Don't become a Benjamite in this regard and let people off the hook and assume, well, it's all, you know, we all are human and we all... No, if a believer is purposely, willfully choosing to ignore the truth and to cave into sin, we have a responsibility not to stand with them, but to stand for them in the sense of for God on their behalf. What's God want for this? God doesn't want this. You know, God wasn't in any of that. This is something the tribes concocted up to try to resolve a situation because the Benjamites wouldn't deal with sin. And it led to a terrible, terrible situation in the land. You know, Paul dealt with one of the main issues of his letter in the book of Romans, the relationship between the growing Gentile church and the original Jewish stock that made it up. And in his discussion as the apostle, a well-trained and former zealous Pharisee, he made the following statement regarding God's grace. Now, could he have had in mind the sad events of the Gibeah affair as he gives us the details of his own personal background? But as for Israel, he said, all the day long I've stretched my hands to a disobedient, obstinate people. I say then, God has not rejected his people, has he? May it never be. For I too am an Israelite, a descendant of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. Maybe he was thinking about the Gibeah affair when the tribe almost disappeared. What about some observations from the tribe of Benjamin? Well, Moses blesses the tribe in Deuteronomy 33. He says, may the beloved of the Lord dwell in security by him, who shields him all the day, and he dwells between his shoulders. We also observe that Saul was a Benjamite, and his rule over as king over Israel was ferocious. Ferocious against the Philistines. Then we learn that Saul's son Jonathan was also a great Benjamite warrior. You know, he had a brilliant strategy. The Benjamites are amazing when you see them at work in the Bible in terms of their warfare and their ferociousness. Saul and now Saul, Jonathan, you know, Jonathan single-handedly with one of his servants went up a steep rock, climbed up, got to the top of it, and wiped out a Philistine garrison. You can read about it in 1 Samuel 14. 20 soldiers he wiped out. Brilliant strategy. Other ferocious Benjamites were Abner, commander of an army, Sheba and Shimei, who also had tremendous exploits. Esther and Mordecai were stellar examples of Benjamite zeal for the glory of God. They were cousins in a Persian town and boldly instrumental in saving their own people. Let me suggest as we close this morning that as we think about Benjamin and we think about the tribes, the tribal intrigue, the tribal history, we should fully resolve in our own lives to live in such a way that God is pleased. That God is pleased. Paul said it this way, therefore we also have as our ambition, whether at home or absent, to be pleasing to him. 2 Corinthians 5:9. Ambition is a good thing when it is directed toward eternal outcomes. Be as ambitious as you can be. If you have eternal outcomes in mind, go for it. Be ambitious. You want to share the gospel? Do it. You want to lay up treasure in heaven? Do it. You want to pray? Do it. Be as ambitious as you can be. You want to grow and mature spiritually? Do it. You want to study the word? Do it. Be ambitious. When it involves eternal outcomes. Now, Jacob ends his blessing to all the tribes. In verse 28 of Genesis 49, it says in Genesis 49:28 at the end, all these are the 12 tribes of Israel, and this is what their father said to them. When he blessed them, he blessed them, everyone, with the blessing appropriate to him. Interesting. So as you go through that litany of the blessings of Jacob to each of his 12 sons, each blessing was appropriate. Was exactly what God wanted to be said. And so this editorial note concludes with the fact that Jacob shared the blessing that would be the future of the nation of Israel. So I hope you've enjoyed looking at each of the 12 tribes and learning about them individually, understanding their character, understanding what's happening amongst them, just like any family. and what we can learn and lessons that are instructive to us as we go forward. Now, next week, we will tie it all up with a look into the future. What does God have for the 12 tribes yet to come in the prophetic future yet to happen? And that'll be our topic next Sunday. Well, let's pray together. Our gracious Father, it is amazing to study these tribes and to learn about their history, their makeup, the lessons we can learn from them, the fact that they were just human beings just as we are. They had to deal with stuff just as we do. And in many ways, their history is a lesson for us about our own spiritual lives and what we can learn and apply from them that can enhance and strengthen our walk with you. I want to thank you for preserving this history in your scriptures so that we can align ourselves with the truth that it teaches us and bring you honor and glory through it in our own lives. We pray in Jesus' name.